I wonder, are you kind of a monarchist or are you a republican? Do you think having a king and a queen and stuff is a good idea, or would you rather have a president? I think most people in the United Kingdom, and therefore probably most people here, quite like the idea of having a king or a queen. I don't know, maybe that's because of all the pomp and the ceremony and the kind of majesty of kind of state occasions, the tradition of it, so we value tradition, don't we? And of course, it really helps tourism. And actually, liking the monarchy, it helps that the Queen's kind of okay, actually. If she wasn't quite so okay, maybe fewer people would want a monarchy. But of course, she has no power. I think in the 1957 FA Cup final, the referee did check with the Queen whether he could blow the whistle to start the match. But I don't think she even has that power today. She has no real power. But what if the Queen was an absolute monarch? Like the kings and queens we read about in our history books, Henry VIII and all those people. You know, she could kind of say, off with his head, and off his head would come. If the Queen was an absolute monarch, I suspect, actually, that very few of us would be monarchists. We'd all want a president instead. So what is it with Christians who proclaim Jesus Christ is king? Why would they want that? Why would we want Jesus as an absolute monarch who rules and reigns over us? Why would we want that? It seems absolute monarchy is not a good thing. But we have to ask, what kind of king is Jesus? What kind of king is he? What is he like? I mean, what kind of king would you actually want to rule over you in that kind of absolute way? We're looking through the Old Testament book of 2 Samuel, following on from a series we did earlier in 1 Samuel. And here in 2 Samuel, we see a biography, if you like, or the story of, or the account of Israel's first good and great king, King David. And these first 10 chapters, we see David portrayed as the kind of king actually, I think we could all want. David, he is a man after God's heart. He shows us what kingship really should be. He shows us what it's like to live under an absolute monarch who is a good king. And of course, we are seeing how David himself as king is a portrait, is a picture of a greater king, King Jesus. In chapters 9 and 10, at the end of this section, we see something of the kindness of King David. Last time, Spencer showed us from chapter 9 how David shows kindness to Mephibosheth. Now, Mephibosheth, he's the son of Jonathan. And Jonathan was the son of Saul, who was the first king of Israel, who was an enemy of David. He had hounded David and tried to kill David. So by rights, Mephibosheth is a threat to David's throne. He should be David's enemy. But for the sake of his covenant that David had made with Jonathan, he shows him undeserved kindness. Just look there in chapter 9, verse 1. David asked, "Is there anyone still left of the house of Saul to whom I can show kindness for Jonathan's sake?" Now in chapter 10, David is again showing kindness. Let's go to chapter 10 and verse 1. In the course of time, the king of the Ammonites died, and his son Hanun succeeded him as king. David thought, "I will show kindness to Hanun, son of Nahash, just as his father showed kindness to me." So David sent a delegation to express his sympathy to Hanun concerning his father. This word kindness in chapter 9 and in chapter 10, it's the Hebrew word hesed, often translated as steadfast love, compassion, faithfulness, loyalty. These are the what it's meant to evoke. David is showing this kind of kindness, love and compassion and loyalty. But here in chapter 10, the response is quite different from the response he receives in chapter 9. The king of the Ammonites has died. Now, to maybe picture this, if you imagine kind of here's Israel and Jerusalem, from your point of view, the Ammonites live over here. just on the borders of Israel. And Aram is up here in the north on the river Euphrates. So as we talk about these places, maybe you can picture that in your mind of where people are coming from. So the king of the Ammonites dies, so David sends a delegation to Ammon to show sympathy, to show kindness to the son who has lost his father. But Hanan gets some advice from his commanders and his princes, and it's bad advice. He says, David's just spying on you. He wants to find out your weaknesses and come and conquer you. Don't trust these men. They're not really coming to show sympathy at all. And so Hanan heeds this really bad advice. And what does he do? He humiliates this delegation, these diplomats. I mean, it's kind of, they should have diplomatic immunity, shouldn't they? But he shaves off half of their beard and he cuts off their clothes at the buttocks to reveal their nakedness. He humiliates them and he sends them off and have to then walk 30 or 40 miles back to the city of Jericho. David hears about this. He hears about the way his men have been treated, about the humiliation they've suffered. And so he sends more messengers, not to Ammon. He sends them to meet these men. And he says to these men who've been humiliated, stay in Jericho until your beards have grown back, until once more you can kind of stand up tall and proud. The Ammonites maybe think they've made a mistake. Maybe it wasn't a good idea to annoy and humiliate the nation of Israel, who have no doubt a more powerful army. They're a bit worried they're going to get zapped by the Israelites. So what do? Well, they go off to Aram and they send loads of money off and they hire a mercenary army. And this mercenary army comes down to meet them. And again, David hears about this. And so he decides to send Joab, his commander, with Joab's brother, Abishai, with the army into Ammon to counter this threat. But Joab ends up in a bit of a bind because he comes to the city, the capital city of the Ammonites, and there is the Ammonite army, and the Aramean army is behind him. And he's caught between two armies, which is very bad militarily. So Joab comes up with a strategy. He says, I'll divide my army into two. My best men I will send against the Arameans. Meanwhile, Abishai, my brother, you can attack the Ammonites. And he says, actually, well, if I get under pressure, you come and help me. But if you get under pressure, I'll come and help you. In the end, the strategy is a good strategy, but it's not needed because the Arameans flee before David, before Joab. They are routed completely. And the Ammonites, seeing they're outnumbered, quickly scuttle back into their city. And Joab and the Israelite army, they return home. Seems like everything's over. That's all hunky-dory, all sorted. Except the Arameans, who are part of a mighty empire, they're feeling a bit humiliated now. They've been kind of defeated by this king of Israel. So they gather more troops, a bigger army. And they come down to attack Israel. And again, David hears about this. He's got a really good spy network, I think, David. And he hears what's happening. And so he himself, the king, gathers all of Israel together. And the entire army of Israel, the men of Israel, go out to meet this threat of the Aramean army. And he utterly destroys that army. And he kills the commander. And he kills tens of thousands of their men. And the kings who used to be subject to the king of Aram, who used to be their kind of cronies, they come to David and sue for peace and make peace with David. But that's the story. Perhaps a familiar story, perhaps not. But I wonder, what should we learn from this story? Well, there are just three things, and they all begin with R. The first thing is we should learn is to receive the king's kindness. Receive the king's kindness. Do you see how kind David is? How he sends this delegation to offer sympathy to a foreign king. I mean, he could have used this as an opportunity to go and conquer Ammon. You know, often a change of king is an opportunity to go and attack and destroy an enemy. You see, although David and Nahash, the king who had died, seem to have some kind of understanding, we don't know what it is, we don't know what kindness Nahash had shown David. Historically, the Ammonites had always been Israel's enemy. They were a threat to Israel. He could have gone and used that opportunity to wipe them out. But instead he offers kindness and sympathy and love to this foreign king. And in this we see something, do we not, of the kindness of King Jesus. How King Jesus still reaches out in kindness even to his enemies. You see, we're all enemies of God by nature. In other words, we're born that way. We're born as God's enemies, as rebels and sinners against him. And we prove that because we're all God's enemies in our practice, by what we do, by our behavior. We refuse his rule. We disobey his commands. We're all enemies of God. But even so, he reaches out to us in kindness through Jesus. He comes and offers peace and reconciliation and forgiveness. If only we'll submit to his rule. If only we'll bow to King Jesus. We see that in John chapter 3, verse 16. For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish but have eternal life. God loved the world. That word, it means people who were enemies of God, who were organized in opposition to God. He loved his enemies so much that he sends his Son in kindness. I wonder how do you respond to this kind of love, to this kindness, to the kindness that he comes to offer you? Will you receive the king's kindness? Some people hear this message of kindness and love and compassion that Jesus shows, and they listen to their friends and they listen to bad advice, as does King Hanan. And like Hanan, they reject the kindness this king is showing them. They reject the kindness of King Jesus and maybe respond with aggression. We see throughout this story how David is not actually the aggressor. He's not on the offensive in this story. His military actions, they're just responses to the plots and plans of his enemies. So just look at verse 7 and verse 17. You can see in both cases, David's told about something. He hears about enemy aggression. And then he sends and he gathers and responds to that threat. You see, he's not fighting these battles for his own pride, for his own renown, for the sake of his name. He's not fighting these battles to win territory. He doesn't follow up this victory with invasion. So it is with Jesus. When Jesus came, he did not come to judge and to condemn the world. He came to save the world. We read John 3:16. The very next verse says this: God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but to save the world through him. Jesus comes to offer peace, but people rejected him. You see, there's no neutrality in this. If you're not with King Jesus, then you're against him. And God isn't out to bash people. He's out to save people. And now is the time for salvation. And Jesus is reaching out in love and kindness and compassion and mercy to a world that's rejected him. His response to the world's rejection is not a lashing out. It's not coming in conquest, but coming in love to show kindness. This is the kind of king that Jesus is. He's a king who shows kindness. He's a king who offers mercy and love. Will you receive the king's kindness? Secondly, relay the king's kindness. We see how David, he sends out this delegation of his people, doesn't he, to show kindness to King Hanan, to the Ammonites. And so to Jesus, he is the good king, and he shows kindness to a world that's rejected him, a world in enmity, by sending out his messengers with the gospel of peace. Jesus actually sends us out to offer the gospel of peace. I'd like to turn to Matthew and chapter 28. Matthew 28 on page 705. And here is Jesus, after his resurrection, speaking to his disciples. And here's what he says to them. Verse 18, Jesus came to them and said, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me." You see how Jesus declares his total authority. He says, "I am the king of all things. It's all been given to me." And because he is king, because of the authority he's been given, he sends out his disciples to make disciples. Verse 19, Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. And surely I am with you always, to the very end of the age. You see how King Jesus here commissions his disciples. He commissions people who follow Jesus. He commissions Christians to call people to submit to him, to follow Christ as king. As our motto verse for the year says, "You will be my witnesses in Jerusalem and in all Judea and Samaria and to the ends of the earth." We are commissioned to relay the king's kindness, to tell people about the kindness of King Jesus. That's what our message is. To go to a world that's rejected him, to offer them his kindness. And so we're to do that, aren't we, with kindness and compassion. To go with kindness and compassion. Not to go with anger and judgmental spirit. But to go gently and warmly to encourage people to receive the king's kindness. Because we're holding out this wonderful gift. We're holding out to people the gift of God's love and forgiveness. And the way that we relay the message changes the way the message is heard. It's a message of grace, so we need to offer it in a spirit of grace. Do we relay the king's kindness? Of course, when we do that, like David's delegation, like David's messengers, we may also suffer disgrace and shame for the sake of the gospel. As they were humiliated in that way, we may also feel humiliation and shame as people respond to the king's kindness with rejection. But just as David, King David, is quick to respond to the humiliation of his people with kindness, our king is quick to respond to our disgrace. Like David cares for his people, so Jesus cares for us. So we can be assured that Jesus cares for us. And ultimately he will hide our disgrace and our shame and one day crown us with glory. And when we do suffer shame as we relay the king's kindness, actually we're just following the example of our king. Our king, King Jesus, he came to suffer shame and humiliation. He was insulted and mocked and ridiculed and beaten, and his beard was torn out. He was humiliated and shamed as he hung naked on a tree, bearing the shame and the curse that is ours. The writer of the Hebrews puts it this way. He says, "For the joy set before him," this is Jesus, "he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinners, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart." You see, Jesus calls on us to love our enemies, to pray for those who will persecute us. We're called upon by King Jesus to suffer shame for the sake of the gospel as we show them his love and his kindness. And when we suffer shame and humiliation, Jesus knows. He's been through it already. He suffered the shame and humiliation that we could never face. He's experienced it. He understands it. So despite the shame, let us go on to relay the king's kindness. And thirdly, let's rest in the king's kindness. Rest in the king's kindness. We've said already that David's stance in this chapter, he's not the aggressor, he's not the invader. He's not starting these battles, these wars. Instead, he is fighting to defend his people and to defend his cities from being invaded. Look at what Joab says in the key verse of this chapter, chapter 10 and verse 12. He's speaking to Abishai, and he says there, "Be strong and let us fight bravely for our people and the cities of our God." Do you see the kindness of the king as he fights or sends out his army to fight for the sake of his people, to protect his people? You see, David, who shows kindness to this foreign king, he now shows kindness to his own people when they're threatened by that very same king. His military action here is not about conquest, it's about protection. And when we step out to share the gospel, in whatever way we do that, when we share the compassion and kindness of Jesus with others, we can do that knowing we're not alone, we're not ultimately vulnerable. You see, even if our reaching out in kindness results in shame and humiliation or even the threat of violence, he doesn't leave us alone. Jesus promises to be with us. We read earlier in Matthew 28, "Surely I am with you always to the very end of the age." And that is a promise that is a promise in the context of witness, in the context of making disciples, in the context of relaying his kindness to the world. He's with us as we are witnesses to the very end of the age. That's one way that we can rest in the king's kindness. But there's another way that Jesus shows us his kindness, and that is through our brothers and our sisters. We see in this passage how the army is surrounded, and what happens, Joab and Abishai, they kind of divide into two to help one another and to support one another. If either comes under pressure, the other can go to help them. And so too, Jesus shows us kindness by giving us one another, that we can assist one another, we can help one another. That Jesus, he sends us out not as individuals, but in a community. We're not on our own. Even in the Gospels, Jesus, when he sent out his disciples on those mission trips, he sent them out in pairs. And he's brought us together here at Emmanuel to be together in community, to support and help each other. So maybe we've had a bad time witnessing. Maybe you've gone out and you kind of be confused by the person. You couldn't answer their questions. You didn't know what to say. I think it happens to all of us from time to time. Well, we can come and we can share that with each other, share it with our brothers and sisters. We can pray together, find out we're not alone in this. And maybe someone can help us with the question that we really couldn't answer. Maybe at school you're mocked for your faith. You're ridiculed for being a Christian. Well, you have brothers and sisters to share that with. You can support one another. You can help one another. And where possible, we can do our witnessing together, actually. We can introduce Christian friends to non-Christian friends. And we can spend time together as the community of God's people, displaying the kindness of God to non-Christians. You see, it's by the kindness of King Jesus that we have him with us and we have each other. We can rest in the king's kindness. And then we go trusting the Lord to do what is right. Go to verse 12 again. Joab says, "Be strong and let us fight bravely for our people and the cities of our God. The Lord will do what is good in his sight." Do we trust the Lord to do what is good in his sight? Of course, what's good in his sight may not be good in our own sight. In 1956, in a remote jungle in Ecuador, five young men were trying to bring the good news of Jesus to a hostile and lost people. And in so doing, they were killed by local tribesmen, speared, leaving behind them wives and families and friends. It was good in God's sight for those young men to die. But what good, you might ask, what a waste. But as a result of their story, thousands of Christians have been moved to go to remote parts of the world to share the gospel and to bring the good news of Jesus to lost people. And some of those people who were involved in that murder, some of those tribesmen themselves have come to faith in Christ. You see, what's good in God's sight may not be what's good in our sight, but we can still rest in the king's kindness, in the kindness of a good king. What kind of king is King Jesus? He is an absolute monarch, but he's kind, he's loving, he's compassionate, he's gracious, both to his enemies and also to his people. But he is an absolute monarch. And as a result, therefore, the king's victory is inevitable. Even when beaten back for the first time, the Arameans have not had enough. They come back for more. And they're utterly defeated. Again, David is just responding to a threat to his people. He doesn't start it. But he's not passive. He goes out with intent and destroys this enemy of his people. And in so doing, we see how their plotting and even their military might is futile. They might be a mighty empire, but their army is dismissed off the pages of history in a couple of sentences. And throughout 2 Samuel to this point, we've seen that no one's been able to withstand David and his armies. And actually, this chapter in particular, 2 Samuel 10, it's a kind of a living commentary on the second psalm, on Psalm 2. I'd like to turn to Psalm 2, page 384. Psalm 2 is a coronation psalm written by David. And of course, it's talking really about Jesus. Let's read there from verse 1. Why do the nations conspire and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth take their stand and the rulers gather together against the Lord and against his anointed one. Let us break their chains, they say, and throw off their fetters. You can see there, can't you, the Ammonites and the Arameans, how they plot against the Lord's king. And you can see there the enemies of Jesus and how they plot against the Lord's king. Let's carry on, verse 4. The one enthroned in heaven laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. Then he rebukes them in his anger and terrifies them in his wrath, saying, I have installed my king on Zion, my holy hill. And then the king speaks. I will proclaim the decree of the Lord. He said to me, you are my son. Today I have become your father. Ask of me and I will make the nations your inheritance, the ends of the earth your possession. You will rule them with an iron scepter. You will dash them to pieces like pottery. We see there David as king, God's king, destroying his enemies. We see there King Jesus. And in verse 10, therefore, you kings, be wise. Be warned, you rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you be destroyed in your way. For his wrath can flare up in a moment. Blessed are all who take refuge in him. We see there are two responses to this king. You can resist and fight and scream and yell and shout and reject his kingship and know certain defeat and be dashed to pieces like the Arameans. Or you can submit to this king. You can kiss the Son, you can bow to him and know his blessings. You take refuge in him as the subjects of the Arameans, as those other kings did that, and they came to King David and they as it were, they kissed him and submitted to his rule. And because he's a good king, because he's a kind king, submitting to his rule, taking refuge in him means blessing. I wonder, what will you do? Because no one can withstand Jesus and his forces. He promised he will build the church. And the gates of Hades will not withstand it. Not even death can stop this happening. We've been looking at the book of Revelation over recent months. We finished it a month or two ago. And we saw there that for King Jesus, his victory is inevitable. Absolute monarchy is a bad thing, isn't it? When it involves a fallen human king. You have tyranny and kind of selfishness displayed, But when the absolute monarch is good and loving and kind, that's a great thing. Jesus is this king. He's the king of kindness and compassion. He offers his kindness and love. Will you receive it? And if you've received and know his kindness, will we relay it to others and rest in it? Because Jesus the King, his victory is inevitable.